Welcome, everybody. Good to see all of you tonight. As we were singing that song, I hope you meant what you were saying. This is not our home, and sometimes it's so easy to forget that. We get comfortable. God gives us nice things. He really blesses us a whole lot. But through all of that, we have to remember that this isn't what it's all about. When I first moved up to Minnesota, I spent a summer there in Minneapolis, and during that summer I lived with different families that were part of the church there, and I'd usually spend about a month in one with one family and then move to another house and then on to another, and that was a lot of fun for a lot of reasons, but one thing that I learned about that is that home could really be anywhere. I mean, it didn't have to depend on having your own place and being able to fix it up just the way you wanted it to be. There's so many things ways that we often define home or think of home that I learned just didn't have to really be there. Home is about where we belong, where we're going, and what we invest in, where we put our faith in. So as you sing that tonight, that you were thinking about that, give that some thought the rest of this week. We're going to our home, but it's not here. We got to remember that in the decisions that we make, in the example that we live. And really, everything we've talked about this week, we talked about influence. If we don't understand that concept, that this world isn't our home, then that's really going to hurt our ability to have influence. I mean, the things that we try to do as Christians, and I hope that this week has been helpful to you. It's helped me a lot because it challenges me to change the way that I think. I'm going to go back to Duluth tomorrow, and the thing that we struggle with there, I think, the challenge for us there is the challenge for you all here. We live in a culture that doesn't look at this, that looks at this as our home. It doesn't look to heaven. And our challenge is, instead of being comfortable with that and instead of blending in and sitting back and making the easy choice, our challenge is to stand out and to be the people that look different and to be comfortable with that enough that we're willing to talk about it. Tonight we're going to finish the study that we started last night talking about tactics. Methods that we can use to be better with our influence and to be more evangelistic. Last night we talked about the first two tactics, and we defined tactics really as ways to help people move closer to the truth, or ways to advance spiritual conversations, ways to help us show people when they're not thinking logically about their faith or about the Bible or about moral issues or things like that. And last night we talked about the first two ones, the Columbo tactic and the suicide tactic. Now, just to quickly summarize, the Columbo tactic was learning to ask informed or educated questions to advance the conversation. Things that clarify. Somebody makes a claim, and instead of trying to defend that or trying to go on the offensive automatically, let them have the burden of proof. Ask them questions about their claim, questions like, well, what do you mean by that? Or how did you arrive at that conclusion? Or what evidence do you have for that? Have you ever thought about this? Or what about this problem? Or what about this difficulty that is presented with your view? Just asking questions like that. We also talked about the suicide tactic. And this is learning to be aware when people use arguments that are self-destructive. Learning to see the seeds of that self-destruction in the argument, and then learning to bring that out with good questions. Now, the other five we're going to talk about tonight, I mentioned them last night very briefly. We'll just go through them in order, and we'll start with taking the roof off. Now, again, you may already have a picture of what this means, but really this plays on the fact that basically all arguments or all belief systems are like houses in a way. You go through a process to get to your final belief, and And a lot of conclusions that people draw are like roofs. You know, you have your initial premises, you lay the foundation, and then you build on that. You put up your walls and all of that. You try to build on the foundation that you've laid, and then it ends with a conclusion or a roof. The funny thing is, as you talk to people that make claims that you may realize are inconsistent and don't hold true if you carry it out to its conclusion, they may not always think about that. And some people, or many people, don't think logically to the argument's end, to its natural conclusion. Sometimes people make arguments that by their own standard aren't consistent. They just don't see it yet, but if you take it to its logical conclusion, then you can help them understand it. And that's what taking the roof off is. It's identifying or adopting a position and carrying it to its natural conclusion. Let me give you an example of where Jesus did this in Scripture that I think is helpful, and then we'll look at some modern-day examples that we often hear about. Matthew chapter 12, I want us to go there and just look at this very briefly. Verses 24 through 26, Jesus has been performing miracles for some time now, and the Pharisees and the chief priests and leaders have tried to discredit him. We saw back in John 9 on Monday night that one thing they tried to do was just deny the miracles. The problem was they were irrefutable. You can't deny when somebody who's all his life been blind can now see, or when people who were lame can now walk. So what did they do then? Well, when they couldn't deny the miracles, what they tried to do is they tried to deny the source from which these miracles came. And we see that here in chapter 12, verse 24. When the Pharisees heard this, that is, that Jesus cast a demon out of a man who was blind and unable to speak. When the Pharisees heard this, they said, "This man drives out demons only by Beelzebul, the ruler of the demons." Knowing their thoughts, he told them, "Every kingdom divided against itself is headed for destruction, and no city or house divided against itself will stand. If Satan drives out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand?" Jesus is using this tactic. You see what he does. He says, okay, let me just adopt your premise. Let me just make that my argument, and let's see where this goes. If I'm really casting out demons by the ruler of demons, then what's going to be the end result? The end result is that this kingdom isn't going to stand. There's no way that I can be doing this in the name of Satan, because it just won't make sense. And he makes this point, and I think they understand that. But this is sort of a variation or an example of that in Scripture. Now let's look at a few common examples of this that we come across today. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about the idea that they believe that Jesus is a good moral person. They think he was a good teacher and he did some nice things and he was kind and compassionate and we should be like him. But he wasn't the Son of God and we don't have to give our lives to him. I mean, if you want to follow or listen to the guidelines that he gives us, great. They'll help your life. They'll make you nicer. But we don't have to give our whole lives to him. Let's just examine that argument and try to take it to its logical conclusion. Because the problem with that is that Jesus, in his own teaching, said some pretty incredible things like, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." He said things like, "Unless you believe, you will die in your sins." I mean, over and over and over through the Gospels, he makes the claim that he is deity. He is the Son of God. Now, there are either two options of that. Let's just take this to its conclusion. Either he was telling the truth, or he was lying. And maybe you've heard this called different things. Some people call this the trilemma, or the Lord, liar, lunatic idea. But here's how it goes. Jesus was either telling the truth or he was lying. Now, if he was lying about what he said, there are also two possibilities about that. Either he was lying and he knew it, which makes him not a very good moral person, does it? I mean, if somebody comes into the world and they're telling lies about themselves, they're claiming to be God's son, and they're saying, "You have to believe in me, you have to believe in me or you'll die." And their whole life is spent trying to convince people that's the truth, and they know that it's false. That's not a very good moral person. So either he was lying, or the other option is that he was deluded. That he thought he was telling the truth, but the reality was he was just out of his mind. Now, what person wants to give their life for somebody who's nuts? Those are the two options if he was not telling the truth. Either he was a liar or a lunatic. The only other option is that he was telling the truth. And if that's the case, then we can't stand back and say, well, he was just a nice guy, and maybe he teaches some good things, but I don't have to believe he's the Son of God. If he's telling the truth, then I better believe that there's a lot at stake here in whether or not I give my life to him. Now, at that point, people have to make their decision. Am I going to follow him or not? But you see what that does? It takes away this nice, politically correct argument that people often use that, well, he was a nice guy, and I think he teaches some nice things, but I don't have to follow him. It takes that argument to its logical conclusion and shows its inconsistencies. How about another one? The concept that's prevalent today of moral relativism, that what is right for you under a certain circumstance may not be right for everybody. And you can't define absolutely what right and wrong are. A few years ago, and maybe some of you remember this, I don't think I ever went through this in school, but I understand in some places, parts of the country, it was pretty prevalent. There was something taught in schools called values clarification. And the idea was that the teacher would present the students with a scenario that was supposed to clarify what they valued. One of these things. You know, you got like nine people and a boat, and they have to get across the river to live, and you only have room for eight, or you have nine people in a desert and food for eight, or, you know, those kinds of things. What do you do? Who dies? Or do you just share it all and then everybody dies? Or, you know, and it was intended to clarify values. Now, there was, I believe this was in Massachusetts where this happened. There's a teacher who was teaching on this, and her students got together one day in the back of the classroom, and they decided that as they were clarifying their values, that they valued, or they thought that it was okay to cheat on tests. And so they all got together and they presented this value to their teacher. Now the teacher said, basically, well, you can't do that. But you see the problem, if what you value is right to you, and if morality is relative, how can you tell me that something that I think is right is wrong? Now her answer to that was something like, well, you're in my classroom and I value honesty, so you have to as well. But that's not even consistent, because just because she values it doesn't mean that I have to value it. And so you see that it just doesn't hold up there. And really that's all, I mean, that's this whole concept of moral relativism. When I was in Arkansas, first kind of training to preach or working to try to do that, I was working with a guy, a preacher named Barry Kirchival. And he took a trip to go to Florida to preach a meeting. And this was one of the things that he was talking about when he was down there, was this idea of moral relativism. And on the flight down there, he was talking to this lady about that. And he got into a conversation with her, and she started saying things like, well, I think that, you know, you can't define morality. What's right for you, or what's wrong for you can be right for me, and all this stuff. And so Barry just looked at her and he said, so you wouldn't mind if I stole your purse, would you? And she kind of looked at him, and she put her purse on the other side of her, and you know, she kind of watched him the rest of the flight. But she got the point. The point is that if stealing your purse is right for me, who are you to tell me that I'm wrong? If morality is defined by what's right in my worldview, if morality is relative, in other words, I can do whatever I want, and if I believe that that's moral, then you can't stop me. And you can get into all kinds of dangerous situations. If I believe it's right to kill, who are you to judge otherwise? I mean, so what we do in these scenarios is we adopt this position and we carry it to its logical conclusion. How about another one? Have you ever heard of the minimalist ethic? Maybe you've heard that, maybe not, but you probably have, if you haven't heard the term, you're familiar with it. It's the idea that, well, as long as I'm not hurting anybody, it's okay. I mean, I can do whatever I want to if it's not harming you or anybody else. And this is often used to talk about things like illegal activity like drug use or homosexuality. Well, I'm not hurting anybody, so what's the problem? Well, I think, first of all, it's worth asking the question, maybe a good Columba question, is it really harmless? I mean, when you think about the results of those two activities that I just mentioned, illegal drug use and homosexuality, it's hard to make the argument that that's harmless. I mean, when you consider the fact that that those two activities have ended up resulting in, really the two primary reasons that certain diseases are prevalent in our country, like HIV and AIDS, can you really say that it's not harming anybody? And that's a question worth asking. But even if they say that it's not, well, maybe you could present this idea to them. So let me get this straight. If as long as I'm not hurting anybody, it's okay with you, what do you think about, you must not have any problems with like a peeping Tom. I mean, if I were to come over to your house and look into your bedroom as you were changing, would you have a problem with that? And I think most people would be pretty disgusted by that. But you make the point to them, well, but if it's not hurting you, if you don't know about it, what's the problem? And see, what we're showing by this is that by their own standard, people aren't willing to live in the world that their belief would produce. Or if somebody says that, maybe you, I don't know if you're sitting at a table with them and you're at dinner or lunch or something, you could say, well, what if I spit in your drink? You could try that. and they might get all disgusted and you say, but I would stir it up and you wouldn't know about it. Nobody's okay with that. That's, you know. And so what we do is we point out the flaws when you carry this to its logical conclusion. They're not willing to live with the implications of their own beliefs. Let me mention a couple other examples of this. Sometimes when people who practice homosexuality claim, well, I don't know what to do because I was just born this way. And as long as I can remember, I've had these urges, these attractions to the same sex. I mean, I've never known anything else. So it must be okay. Well, let's carry that to its logical conclusion. Because there are also people in this world who, as long as they can remember, have had urges, different kinds of urges. For example, they've had urges to hurt people or things. And maybe you could even just assume that. You could say, well, let me just say this. What if I told you that ever since I was a little kid, I can always remember this, I never know anything different. Every time I get around a homosexual, I have this urge to just beat them up. And I don't know where it comes from. I don't want to do it, but I just have this urge. Is that okay with you? Of course not. It's because we expect people to rein in or to control themselves no matter what urges or desires they may have. And what it shows is that it's just because something's natural doesn't mean that we don't expect others to control that. I mean, that's what distinguishes us from animals, right? I mean, the idea of principled self-restraint, saying no to things that I want to do. Or sometimes you'll hear this one. Well, I know in the Bible it says that marriage is supposed to be between a male and a female, but I think that culture has the right to decide that. And that was their culture at that time, but our culture has decided something differently. Okay, well, let's just adopt that. Let's boil it down to its basic premise, that culture decides what's right and wrong. What if our culture one day decided that it was okay to for a man to marry an animal? Or for somebody to marry a dead person? If culture decided that was okay, would that make it okay? And again, most people who make this argument, I would imagine, would be disgusted by that, and they'd say, well, no, that's twisted, that's sick. Well, that's your view. If culture can decide it, what would be wrong with it if that's what we decided as a culture? And you show the fallacy in it that way. One other example before we move on, and we're spending more time on this than the rest of these. When you talk to people who about abortion, this comes up a lot, especially with political types. It's become popular to hold the view of modified pro-choice, where you say something like, well, I don't personally believe in abortion, but I think that people should have the right to choose. And that's become something that people can kind of use as their belief, and politicians do it a lot. And it's nice because you can appeal to both sides. You can sort of ride the fence and everybody likes you and whatever. But think about that. And maybe this is the way you can approach it. Sometimes it's just helpful to restate this person's claim back to them. So let me get this straight. You don't believe, or you would never abort a baby. How about a good Columbo question? Why is that? And probably they'd say something like, well, because I just could never kill a baby. Or because I believe that it's taking the life of a baby. Okay, well, if that's what you believe, but you think that it's okay for other people to kill babies or to take the life of a baby. And when you put it in those terms, sometimes people are kind of put off by it, and they, well, when you put it that way, it doesn't sound quite right. Well, no, it's not when I put it that way. That's your view. And so sometimes it's a matter of just pointing that out and carrying it to its logic, to its natural conclusion. That's taking the roof off. Let's go to the next one. Rhodes Scholar. Rhodes Scholar is simply defined as distinguishing between what an expert says and why an expert says it. Sometimes we quote authorities or experts, or they are quoted by people, and that's as if that's supposed to just end some discussion. Remember back to the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus was first kind of talking about a different standard of morality that God expected. You remember what he said in, like, he repeated this phrase all throughout chapter 5. He said, "You have heard that it was said, but I say to you." Where did that, what they had heard, where did that come from? Well, it came from the experts, the scribes and the Pharisees and all of those. And what Jesus was doing is he was saying, just because some expert says it doesn't make it true. And that's what we got to understand, too. A lot of times this comes into play. I noticed this a lot in college. I went to school to study science, to study biology and chemistry. And I noticed a lot of times when you're talking about things like evolution, people would quote scientists as if that was just supposed to, like, end all discussion. And if a scientist said something was true, then that validated it. But the thing is, I also noticed that people were quoting scientists who made some pretty unsubstantiated claims, but they let them get away with it. And so in those cases, it's helpful for us to go back to the Columbo tactic and remember the second question. Well, what evidence has led you to believe that, or how does this expert know this to be true? I don't know if you've ever heard of something called the Jesus Seminars. I don't think they're as popular now as they were in, maybe back in the 90s or the early 2000s. But the Jesus Seminars were a group of guys that, or a group of individuals that would get together, and they would debate about the authenticity of the events of Jesus' life in the Bible. And so they would say things like, or they would vote on things like, what is the probability that Jesus actually walked on water, or that he actually said these words? And the interesting thing about that is they would vote against the likelihood that Jesus did miracles, and they would say that it was kind of made up by his followers and things like that. But the reason they would give against Jesus walking on water, for example, is because they say something like, well, because humans can't walk on water. So we know he couldn't have really done that. And they would make these conclusions about his miracles and the words that he said based on presuppositions. Now, if I look at the Bible with the presupposition that miracles aren't possible, of course I'm going to conclude that most of what Jesus did couldn't have really happened. But so much of the time, these people from the Jesus Seminar were quoted, like, in magazines and things like that as religious experts or textual critics or things like that. And this is what this tactic is all about. It's not letting people get away with just saying, well, experts say, or science has proven this to be true. The next one is kind of similar to that, just the facts. And this is recognizing and exposing an opinion that is being treated as absolute fact. Doesn't it drive you nuts when people treat their opinion like it's absolute fact, like it's true? By the way, it drives other people nuts when we do the same thing. And let me just stop and say, we have to be careful not to make these same mistakes, because we can do this as well sometimes. And one example that I thought of that may be most common is sometimes we say things like, well, the Bible says, and then we rattle off something that we think it says, but if we're not sure about it, I mean, we have to go back and make sure that what we say it says is really there. Because I've heard Christians say things that the Bible says that really aren't in there. And I think I've at some times in the past have made assertions that weren't there either. We've got to make sure that we get our facts straight as well. But let's talk about another a few examples of this. Again, going back to the idea of evolution. Well, everybody knows that evolution has been proven. Well, how do you know that? I mean, what are your facts for that? And a lot of the claims that people make, or a lot of the things that people will go to as proof that evolution is true, I mean, they'll say things like, well, it's true because you see it in Darwin's finches, or things like that, or you see it in the moths in London, the peppered moths and spotted moths. And they'll use examples of variation within a species to prove that animals from one species can turn into another species. That's taking opinion and treating it as fact. Now, I can talk a lot more about that. I won't for the sake of time. If you have questions about that, talk to me, because that's something that's interested me and I've tried to study quite a bit through. And I'd be glad to talk to you more about that. Another example of this is sometimes people make this claim against Christians. Well, Christianity is responsible for more deaths than anything else ever in the history of the world. What they mean by that usually are things like the Crusades or the Spanish Inquisition or examples of that where Christians have taken up the sword and tried to kill people. But the thing is about that, that's just, or they'll think of things like the Holocaust and people like Hitler. The thing about that is that's just not true. I mean, when you look at the facts and the people over the course of history who have killed the most, it's people like Joseph Stalin or people like Mao Zedong who were completely atheists. Like, they didn't believe in anything. Those are the kinds of people who, if you look up the count of the world's greatest like mass murderers, those are the guys at the top of the list. One other one. When I first moved to Duluth a couple years ago, I got a phone call from a lady. Kieran Murphy, the other preacher up there, had written an article in the newspaper about the reliability of the Bible. And this lady called up the office and wanted to talk to him, and he wasn't there, so I talked to her for a little bit. And she said, I want you to tell him that he needs to do his research a little bit more. And so I just kind of asked her what she meant by that, and she started saying things about how the Bible wasn't true, and everybody knows it's been changed. And I just stopped her after I let her talk and finish. And then I said, but how do you know that? I mean, because here's the thing, I don't believe that it's been changed like you say it has. And so everybody, I mean, not everybody believes that, so what's your proof of that? And she'd go on to say something else, and every claim that she made, she never backed it up, and so I kept asking her. And eventually, I think it kind of caught her off guard, because she probably made these statements and never been challenged, and eventually, she kind of saw what I was saying, but she never really, I mean, and she never really backed up her claims, so we talked a little bit more, and eventually ended the conversation. But the point is that we're trying to put the pebble in the shoe. Trying to give people some element of something where we stand up against them, where they see that the claims that they're making aren't always, you know, or some people stand up against that and don't believe it. Trying to put the smallest element of disagreement in their minds, and let them just think about it. And pretty soon that pebble in the shoe, they walk around on it long enough and it it feels like a boulder. I mean, you can't walk around with a pebble in your shoe indefinitely and not be bothered by it. Okay, let's look at the last couple here. First of all, sticks and stones, and you can probably figure out what this is. Sticks and stones is simply name-calling or belittling. The last two we're going to talk about aren't tactics that we use on people. They're tactics that people sometimes use against us and that we have to defend against. Sometimes in religious discussions, and see how many of you have ever had this happen to you, you start talking to somebody about the Bible or about Christianity or about some moral issue. And how many times do people just try to end the discussion by calling you a name? They'll just say, well, you're ignorant. You just don't know what you're talking about. Or you're intolerant, or something like that. You hear that one a lot. And the point of this one is to be aware of that and to not let people get away with it. The thing about that is, and it's really kind of clever, we live in such a soundbite culture. I mean, you hear 30 seconds of news or a minute of news at a time. We live in such a soundbite culture that somebody can quickly call you a name and get away with that. And if it doesn't go on, if it goes unchallenged, people see that, and that's all it takes to win the argument. What we have to do is challenge when they do that, meet them with the challenge and say, but that doesn't prove what you're claiming. That doesn't negate what I'm saying. A couple examples of that. One that's pretty common is when you try to speak up against homosexuality. What do people often call those who do that? What's the word they say? Well, you're just a homophobe. And here's the interesting thing about that, and you can kind of ask questions about this, Columbo questions, or take the roof off of this. What does that even mean? And maybe you can just ask the person, so what is a homophobe? I mean, what do you mean when you say that? And the definition of homophobe is, I mean, you break it down, homo and phobia, at least the dictionary definition is somebody who's afraid of homosexuals. I think what would be appropriate for us to do is simply make the point, listen, I'm not scared of people like that. I don't have anything to fear from them. I just don't agree with what they're doing. I don't think it's moral, but I'm not scared of them. That doesn't make me a homophobe. Or sometimes people, like I mentioned earlier, will say, well, you're just intolerant. And really, they'll use that anytime you bring up a disagreement with them. They'll say you're intolerant and try to leave it at that. Jeff and I were talking about this last night. The thing is, when people call us intolerant just because we disagree with them, that's inconsistent. What tolerance is it's the courtesy that we give people when we do disagree with them. And so when there's this disagreement, just because I disagree with you doesn't make me intolerant. What would make me intolerant is if I'm not even willing to listen to your position, which actually kind of turns the tables. Who's the intolerant one then? Now, maybe you could try to point that out to them, or you could just say something like, listen, you can call me names if you want to, but ridicule isn't an argument. And you still haven't addressed the claims that you've made, or you still haven't answered my objection to that. by the way, I was just thinking about this earlier today, especially for you young people that are, you're still in school, and you're in situations sometimes where you're around a lot of your peers, and maybe you try to say something about morality, or you try to make some claim, and you ever been in a situation where there's like one person that'll just berate you? And if they're loud enough, and if they're obnoxious enough, and if they call you enough names, then nobody else will challenge them, and that'll be the end of it. I think this is an effective tool to use in situations like that. You let them fly off the handle, or you let them call you names, or whatever, but then at the end you just say, well, but that still doesn't answer my objection to that. Ridicule doesn't argue anything. That's sticks and stones. Now the last one is called steamroller. And this is when people make claim after claim without ever allowing us to adequately address each claim. Sometimes, and I think this happens quite a bit in conversations or in Bible studies, we were also talking about this last night after after our time together. Sometimes you'll be in a Bible study and somebody will bring up a verse and they'll say, but what about this verse? How do you answer that? And then you try to answer it, but they don't let you answer it. Or you give an answer and they say, but what about this verse over here? And you try to go over there and answer that, and they jump over to another one. And just back and forth all the time. And they never really let you answer the initial question. And what's important for us to understand is that when people do that, sometimes they do it unwittingly. Like, it's not always a malicious thing. Sometimes it is. But for example, a few years ago when I was in Arkansas, I had a neighbor of mine that I was studying with. And we'd get together and study, and she'd ask a question about a passage. And so we'd look at that, and I'd try to give her my answer. But before I could finish it, she'd ask me about something else. And she tried to get off on several different things. And I'd try to keep her on the same thing and say, well, let's go back to your initial question. That could be so frustrating when we're in that situation. And the key is to just not let that happen. And really, there's when people try to steamroll us, or when they try to move on to another argument without giving us time to adequately respond or address it, there are really three steps to this. First of all, to handle a steamroller, you simply stop them. You say, and the key here is it's important that we do this in a winsome way. We're not trying to invite hostility. We're trying to keep it away if it's at all possible. So when we're talking to people, it's important that we, when things are getting heated, that we simply stop and step back and kind of smile at them and even use their name. Sometimes the sweetest word that a person can hear is their own name, and it'll really kind of settle hostility down. But the first thing you do is simply point out the fact that they're doing this. Hey, you're asking really great questions, and I appreciate this a whole lot, but I really want to give you answers, and the problem is you're not giving me enough time to really answer your questions, and I'd love to do that, but will you give me enough time, will you allow me enough time to address that? And sometimes that'll be the end of it. I mean, people will understand what they've been doing. They'll say, oh, yeah, sorry, I'll let you speak. If that doesn't work, though, the next thing you can do is just shame them and say, listen, I want to address your questions, but why do you keep doing this? Like, if you're really being honest about this and you want answers, then give me the courtesy of telling you what I have to say, but if you don't really care about what I'm going to say, then I'll be on my way. And then if that keeps up, the last thing, and sometimes you have to do this, you just have to walk away. People keep trying to steamroll you and keep trying to make claims and all that. And sometimes it gets to the point where you just have to say, I'm willing to answer your questions, but I'm not sure if you're really interested in the answers that I have to give, because I've been trying to answer you and you haven't listened to anything that I've said yet. Now I'll let you talk and say whatever you want to say, and I'd be happy to sit here and listen to you. But when you're done, I'm going to go, unless you really want to have a discussion here. And sometimes that's what you have to do. You just have to get up and walk away. Now, when we're having discussions with people, sometimes, and by the way, I think we see Jesus doing that. We looked at the example in examples in Matthew 21 and 22 where Jesus responded with questions. Sometimes when he didn't get answers to his questions, or when he could tell that his audience wasn't being honest, he'd just leave. And I think that's an appropriate and sometimes even the most helpful thing that we can do. Sometimes people won't be honest or won't be patient or won't give us courtesy of being good listeners until we step up and do that. And that's the steamroller tactic. Now, one thing about this is sometimes when we're having discussions with people, one great thing that we can do to keep them open-minded and try to reach them is there may be situations where you're going back and forth, and everything they say, you feel like you got to get the last word in and answer or give a rebuttal to their claim. We don't always have to get the last word in. And that's really hard sometimes. It's really hard for me because I always, if somebody issues a claim, I want to challenge it. Sometimes we can actually make a really strong statement to people when we let them have the last word. We make a claim and then they try to answer it. But if we don't feel the need to automatically jump into addressing what they say, sometimes that lets them know that we feel very confident about the things, the claims that we've made. And it can also go a long way towards building the trust with people in discussion that will keep their minds open to what we have to say. Okay, those are the tactics. I want to just say a few things briefly as we close tonight. I'm not teaching these as somebody who's a professional at this or somebody who's got all these things down. These are things that I'm constantly working on to try to get better. The critical thing is simply we just got to practice them. I mean, the only way that we get more effective and the only way that we get better at this is practice, practice, practice. And I think we mentioned this a little bit earlier in the week. All of the tactics and all of the knowledge and all of the wisdom and the conversational skill won't do us a bit of good if we're never willing to get out and just talk to people. So try this. I mean, try to practice it. And it won't come right away. It's not an easy thing to pick up. I still have conversations with people all the time where I'm thinking, man, that was I didn't handle that well at all. I wish I had said this, or why didn't I think to say that? And that's okay, because all we're doing, again, remember, is we're trying to put the pebble in the shoe. Give people just a small thing to think about that's going to challenge them. And then trust that God can do things with that. Another thing about this is you may practice these and you may start to feel good about them and what you're doing. You may have a lot of success in one conversation. And you may think, okay, I've found the method. But just be prepared, because every conversation is different. I mean, I've had conversations that were great with people and I thought, okay, now I think I can use this. And I tried it in the next conversation and it fell flat. It didn't get me anywhere. People are different. Different things convince different people. And that's why one of the most important things for us is simply to be observant in conversation and to listen, really listen to what people have to say. And really seek out the answers to their questions as people who are interested in truth. That's who we are. That's who we should be. All right. Turn with me to one final passage as we close this tonight. I want to take a look at something that God tells Ezekiel in Ezekiel 3. I hope that all of this has been helpful to motivate you and to get you thinking more evangelistically. And we want to be skilled at it and we want to save souls. But let's not forget that part of this too is because we want to be more like Jesus. I mean, I can bring tons of people to the Lord, but at the end of the day, if I'm not living right, that doesn't do me any good. And most of the time, that will severely impact my ability to reach others. I want to look at something that God tells Ezekiel and leave you with this tonight. Just as something to think about when we're trying to maybe trying to get over the hump of being bold in our conversations with people. Look at what God told Ezekiel down in starting in verse 16. It says, "Now at the end of seven days, the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, I have made you a watchman over the house of Israel. When you hear a word from my mouth, give them a warning from me. And if I say to the wicked person, you will surely die, but you do not warn him, you don't speak out to warn him about his wicked way in order to save his life, that wicked person will die for his iniquity. Yet I will hold you responsible for his blood. But if you warn a wicked person and he does not turn from his wickedness or his wicked way, he will die for his iniquity, but you will have saved your life. Now if a righteous person turns from his righteousness and practices iniquity, and I put a stumbling block in front of him, he will die. If you do not warn him, he will die because of his sins, and the righteous acts he did will not be remembered. Yet I will hold you responsible for his blood. But if you warn the righteous person that he should not sin, and he does not sin, he will indeed live because he listened to your warning, and you will have saved your life." You know, to be honest, sometimes when I'm not as bold as I should be, It's because I don't realize what's at stake. And I don't just mean what's at stake for the person I'm talking to. We talked about that in 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 5 on Sunday. We should have fear of the Lord for other people, or we should have fear for other people of how they're going to answer the Lord. But notice what God told Ezekiel. He said, if you don't warn them, and they continue in their wickedness, they're going to die, but the blood's going to be on your hands. That scares me to death. I don't want to get to the judgment day and to stand before God and have blood on my hands. And what this is all about is it's about making sure that we get the blood off of our hands. Making sure that we do everything we can to try to reach the lost, to save their souls, to be sure. But also to make sure that we've done what God wants us to do. That's our purpose. That's why God saved us. Let's do that. Go ahead and take your songbooks out. Thanks so much for your attention, for all of the thought that you've given us tonight. Take this with you and use it to challenge you to grow, to be more Christ-like. And that's how we change. It's how we change churches. It's how we change towns and cities. It's how we change the world. God changes the world through individuals. He changes it when you and I make the decision to change ourselves. So let's be making those decisions. If you're here tonight and you have a spiritual need, maybe you've never changed your life. Maybe you've never given it to God. You can do that this evening. Turn from your sins and profess that from now on you're going to follow Jesus. You're going to let him be your master. And you can have those sins washed away in baptism this very night. If you've done that, but you're not living in a way that backs it up, if you're not walking worthy of the calling with which God's called you, turn that around tonight. And if we can help you in any way, come to the front and let us know while we sing this song.